our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated.
With these words, on September 20, 2001, American President George W. Bush declared war on, in air quotes, terror. 20 years later, America has chaotically pulled out of Afghanistan with nothing much to show for it, and the war on terror appears to have achieved very little except to cause more terror and to bring America's violence to more parts of the world. In today's fascinating conversation, Arun Kundanani interviews Deepa Kumar, who traces the longer historical roots of the war on terror and how it racialized and targeted Arab and Muslim communities well before 9/11. Deepa Kumar is the author of the recently published book, Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire, 20 Years After 9/11. Arun Kundanani is a TNI associate and author of The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror.
My name is Arun Kundanani, and in this series of interviews, we meet people who can offer a different vision of what global security should look like in an era of pandemics and climate crisis. This week is 20 years since 9/11. Nearly 3,000 people died in the worst single day of mass violence in modern history. Yet hundreds of times more people died in the global war on terror that was launched in the days that followed. The US and its junior partners, like the UK, are most likely responsible for needlessly killing over a million men, women, and children. This was an industrial slaughter of the poor in the Middle East, in Africa, and in South Asia. In the scale of the violence, it ranks alongside the major genocides of the 20th century, such as in Armenia or in Rwanda. And this was a bipartisan project in the United States. The neoconservatives around the Bush administration launched the war on terror, but the liberals around the Obama administration continued it and made it permanent. Even now, there's been no accountability. The cheerleaders, the planners for the war on terror are simply going on to their next gig. They're still in business. Even the liberal media, such as the New York Times or NPR Radio, has never fully recognized and acknowledged that the United States has been responsible for launching a global campaign of mass violence that led to the deaths of over a million people. Now, the only way to understand how this was possible is to understand that the victims of the war on terror were racially dehumanized. The racist association of Islam with terrorism, with extremism, with fanaticism, with barbarism, all this was central to that process of dehumanization. Now, to think more about how anti-Muslim racism has enabled this kind of US imperialism, I spoke with Deepa Kumar. Deepa is a professor of media studies at Rutgers University and has a new edition of her book out from Verso Books, Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire, which I'd strongly recommend. This is an absolutely superb interview with Deepa. She lays out precisely how the association of terrorism with Islam emerged and how that idea enabled the mass violence of the war on terror. Remember, if you enjoy the interview, please like and subscribe and look out for more interviews in the coming weeks. Deepa Kumar, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, let's begin by thinking about the concept of terrorism today in the United States. And when people talk about terrorism, it seems almost second nature to have an image in our heads of the Muslim extremist. Do you think that's just the kind of inevitable consequence of 9/11?
Yeah, I think so. Even though there's a longer history to this association, I think that what 9/11 did, because it was such a dramatic event and one that was televised and repeated over and over again, that it got seared in people's imagination, not just in the US, but around the world, of the image of Muslims as being terrorists, so being extremists and what have you. And I think that there are dramatic moments in history that enable certain kinds of thinking. And even though, you know, the number of people who died on 9/11 is 3,000, and that's a tragic event, there's no doubt about it. There's a way in which that has been mobilized to suit US imperial aims around the world, which is centered around this image of a dangerous Muslim extremist who must be kept in check to keep the US as well as the world safe. And of course, what gets elided in this discussion is the immense destruction that the US itself has produced through the war on terror. Hundreds of thousands of people have been killed in Muslim-majority countries in the Middle East, in North Africa, in Central Asia, and South Asia. And I'm taking, you know, very conservative estimates here. I'm taking the figures from the Watson Institute at Brown University, where they record from U.S. wars in six countries the number of deaths, excess deaths, directly related to U.S. wars. But if you factor in, the consequences of war, the fact that infrastructure is destroyed, the fact that people don't have access to clean water, to hospitals, and so on, the figures are in the millions. And so that gets elided in favor of a framework that suggests that somehow the U.S. is a force for good, keeping the world safe from Muslim terrorists. And the extent to which this is seared in people's imaginations, I've been doing this experiment for the last 20 years, actually, where every time I give a talk, whether it's in the U.S. or in countries around the world, I either use my own computer or, you know, some other computer at a hotel or university that I'm staying at to Google the term terrorist. And overwhelmingly and consistently, if you click the images bar, what you see is the image of brown, turbaned, perhaps masked, armed men, as if to say that the only source of violence and terror in the world are Muslims, are Muslim extremists, and not powerful imperial forces who are responsible for far more death and tragedy and suffering. And I'm not even talking about the displacement of millions of people as a result of the war on terror.
Right. And in your work, you've systematically looked at how that association that you were just talking about has come about. And you go back through the history of the term terrorism in the United States and public discourse from the period of the late 1960s right up to today. And you find that, is this right, that after the late 1960s, the idea of the Arab terrorist was created? Can you talk about how that happened?
Yeah, absolutely. So basically, there was no language of terrorism in the US prior to the late 1960s and early 1970s. The term was used occasionally, and there were a variety of actors who were associated with that term terrorist, but there was no consistent language, vocabulary, or discourse around terrorism until the late 60s and early 70s. Now, mind you, I'm not saying that, you know, acts that today are considered terrorism, like the hijacking of planes or kidnapping or the murder of civilian populations and so on, didn't happen back then. Of course it did. But the people responsible, as scholars have shown, were called bandits, or they were called guerrillas, or they were called pirates, or what have you. They were not consistently labeled as terrorists until two significant events take place, one in 1967 and the other in 1972. And so in 67, the pivotal moment was really the Arab-Israeli War of 1967. And Israel defeats its neighboring Arab nations, which it considers enemies, in a matter of 6 days. And that really elevates the usefulness of Israel to the United States in imposing its imperial agenda in the region. It's not always the case that Israel was, you know, of course, it's always had a special relationship, but using Israel as a proxy for U.S. imperial ambitions in the Middle East is something that really develops after 1967. And it's also from Israel that notions of Arab terrorists actually comes in part, and I'm going to expand on this some more, from the Israeli security forces as well. Keep in mind that, of course, in Israel, there's a developed vocabulary around terrorism. Anyone who resisted the Israeli settler colonial project was considered to be a terrorist. And this certainly developed some more in the 1960s after the formation of the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization. So that's one important moment when the language of Arab terrorism and terrorism itself starts to come into the U.S. And that happens through Zionist organizations like AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, and so on, who had actually begun their own surveillance programs of student activists on campuses in the U.S., because they believed that Palestinian solidarity, that activism by student groups, and by the way, a number of Arab American activist groups come, get formed after 1967. And in fact, scholars have argued that an Arab American identity as such was formed after the 67 war. At any rate, these Zionist groups start to see them as threats, as proxies of Arab nationalists in the U.S., and start to conduct their own surveillance. And they convince the FBI and the CIA to actually start to investigate these groups. And they are classified as potential terrorists. Potential because, of course, at the time, the U.S. had no actual evidence of terrorist activity. But they start to do this anyway. Now, I say that Israel is one source because, in fact, by this point, counterinsurgency thinking in the U.S. is actually quite dominant, particularly in the national security sector. And so it's not as if, you know, these groups convinced the FBI and CIA to do something they didn't want to do. There was a merging of interests in terms of seeing who the threats are to the domestic order, as well as the international order. So that's 67. Then in 1972, at the Munich Olympics, the Palestinian group Black September takes Israeli athletes hostage, and in the context of a rescue attempt, actually executes all of them. It's a really grisly turn of events. And this is covered by the worldwide media. The media are there to cover the Olympics. So 900 million viewers, it's estimated, actually got to see this play out. And this becomes, according to scholars of terrorism, this becomes a pivotal moment in elevating the language around terrorism. And in fact, that's when policies in the U.S. Actually start to take hold in some systematic way. Sure, the FBI and the CIA were interviewing Arab American activists and so on, but you actually see a program, for instance, called Operation Boulder, which is a system of visa checking, where they were screening application for potential terrorists from Arab nations. And this was launched immediately after the 1972 Munich incident. And of course, you know, this doesn't come out of the blue. Operation Boulder was basically a program that was exactly like the infamous FBI program COINTELPRO, which went from 1956 to 1971. But it was revived, you know, and this was a program, as you've written very well, Arun, in your brilliant book on surveillance. This was used to target civil rights activists, Black Power activists, American Indians, feminists, and so forth. And the logic of that program was, you know, redeployed through Operation Boulder. And that's when you start to see a systematic wiretapping and surveillance of Arab Americans. In other words, the actions of a handful of Palestinians in Munich becomes the basis from which all Arab Americans are seen as threats and as racialized threats at that.
And so you mentioned the term counterinsurgency as part of the story here. Can you just elaborate a little on what that looks like in the United States at the time?
Sure. So U.S. counterinsurgency thinking during the Cold War goes roughly like this. So the US is one of two superpowers on the global stage, obviously. After the end of the Second World War, previous colonial and imperial nations are losing control over various colonies. You see a massive wave of decolonization struggles from India to Algeria and so forth. And the US is actually now trying to control these parts of the world that earlier it didn't have hegemony over. And of course, it's trying to make the world safe for capitalism, right? So it adopts a program known as modernization theory, which involves various developing nations and post-colonial nations incorporating capitalist measures, five-year plans, all the rest of it, to put themselves on a path towards capitalism. Those who resist are seen as threats. And this is where counterinsurgency comes in, is the thinking at the time is that in order to defeat the Soviet Union, more and more parts of the world has to be brought into the capitalist sphere so as not to fall into the ambit of the Soviet Union. And therefore, there was economic investment in developing nations, but also the use of military force. So one practitioner of counterinsurgency called this armed social work, right? So it's investment combined with coercion. And this actually is seamless. It's how the US looks at the world, but it's also how the US looks at domestic populations as well. So that policing methods and counterinsurgency methods that are used domestically go abroad and travel back, right? Saigon and LA are really two points on a global order that the US is trying to create in the Cold War era.
And you, when you think about insurgency and you're talking about how the United States national security system came to see the Palestinian struggle for self-determination as an insurgency, is your understanding that makes it something that's a little different from the conflicts between Arab nation states and Israel that, you know, had happened before? When you get to the late 60s, it seems that the Palestinian struggle has taken up a kind of mass insurgency of a very different kind. And is that where the counterinsurgency logic starts to kick in? And is that also how the notion of Arabness as a racialized identity starts to take shape? Like where does the racialization come in? You know, you can imagine that after Munich or earlier in 67, that there would be measures to tackle what they would call terrorism, but that could still be done in a way that focused on individuals involved in acts of violence rather than thinking of a racialized identity of the Arab as a kind of racial threat.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And that's a huge question, of course. Let me see how much I can, say of that. I mean, I think that well before there was an ideology of the Arab as a racialized threat, there were practices that actually created racialized groups, right? And that's the important point, is that when the state uses a mechanism by which to go after not just a handful of people that it sees as suspicious and for which there may be legitimate grounds, who knows, but when it targets an entire group of people that it sees as potential threats, that's a mechanism of racialization, right? And you've argued this, of course, in your book about how surveillance itself is a mechanism of racialization. And we've argued in our piece, Empire, Race and Surveillance, how the focus on whole groups and the targeting of whole groups becomes the means by which they get turned into a race and a dangerous and threatening group of people. So, I mean, how to think about this really goes back even to somebody like Aimé Césaire, who in his book, Discourse on Colonialism, talks about how, you know, the acts of a handful of people get generalized to the entire population. Albert Memmi calls this the mark of the plural, where, you know, Black people or brown people doing a certain thing then becomes all brown people, right? So individuality is denied. And that's how racism works, And what I'm arguing is that this happens not necessarily ideologically, but really in the form of state practices in the early 70s. And the ideology actually catches up a little bit later on. But in terms of the Palestinian question, which you raised initially, keep in mind that, you know, as I said earlier, this is the moment of massive national liberation struggles and the use of armed struggle to actually, throw off the yoke of colonialism. And the Palestinian struggle is very important to all of this. And especially after Munich, the UN General Assembly actually meets and discusses how it's going to analyze, how it's going to look at the question of terrorism. And a very important resolution was passed at this UN General Assembly meeting. It was Resolution 3034, in which the General Assembly denounces the violence of what they call colonial and racist powers, by which they mean France and England and Israel and so on. And it actually calls the violence of those states against movements for self-determination as terrorist, right? So this is really significant that you have global opinion at this point in the form of the UN General Assembly saying that there is such a thing called state terrorism and that the use of violence against movements for self-determination can be called terrorism. Of course, Western nations are not at all happy with this resolution. But it doesn't stop there. The year after, Resolution 3070 is passed, which says that there is a legitimacy in the struggle for liberation against colonial and foreign powers, and that people should use any means necessary, including armed struggle, right? And then to make matters worse from the point of view of imperial powers, Yasser Arafat, who is the leader of the PLO, is invited to address the UN General Assembly in 1974, and the Palestinian right to self-determination is recognized and actually elevated by the UN General Assembly. So all of this is very troubling to Western imperial nations, and particularly to the United States and Israel, which by this point had become much closer. And that's the context really for which, that's the context in which two very important conferences are organized by the Jonathan Institute to shape the language around terrorism.
Right. And so that brings us to the 1980s, right? Those two conferences. And are you arguing that it's in the 1980s that the kind of discourse around terrorism shifts from an idea of the Arab terrorist to the idea of the Muslim terrorist? And how does that happen?
Right. So let me back up a little bit. It is not yet dominant in the news media that terrorism is exclusively associated with Arabs. Mm. Or in the 1980s, that it's exclusively associated with Iranians or with Muslims and so on. My own study of the New York Times shows that, in fact, the face of terrorism was largely leftists, predominantly white, because, you know, this was the time when there were mass struggles all over the world. And so it was not until much later, and certainly this gets crystallized only after 9/11, that the predominant face of terrorism is brown and black men, largely, right? And so to go to your specific question, which is what is it that happens in the 1980s that turns this particular threat from Arab terrorists to Muslim terrorists? So let me say a little bit about the two conferences that the Jonathan Institute organizes. The Jonathan Institute was formed in 1976. By Benjamin Netanyahu, the former prime minister of Israel, who, by the way, has played a huge role in the development not only of the language around terrorism and the racialized terrorists, but also in terms of developing policies that various nations would take up and learn from Israel as well. And so the Jonathan Institute is set up in 1976. They are seeing what's happening at the UN General Assembly and not happy. And so the first conference, which is held in Jerusalem in 1979, Netanyahu's father, Benzion Netanyahu, starts by saying that the world community in the UN is falling down on the job of actually addressing terrorism in an appropriate way. And this conference, he says, is about changing, starting a process to change the way in which terrorism is understood and acted upon. And so at that conference, there are a couple of key arguments that are made. Many speakers, and there are speakers, by the way, from all around the world, from France, from Britain, but the main forces there are from the United States and Israel. And so all of these conference speakers, one of the themes that they address is the idea that one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. They hate this, right? They don't like the sort of legitimacy that has been given not only to participants in struggles for self-determination in colonial nations, but also forces in Western nations that are fighting against imperialism, that are fighting for democratic rights, political freedoms, against racism and all the rest of it, like what's going on in the United States, for instance, in the 60s and 70s. And so this conference actually tries to give the ruling elite the language that they need to bring all these forces together, forces that are opposed to empire, to capital, and so forth, and brand them as terrorists, right? So that was an important moment. But at that point, and this happens, mind you, before the Iranian Revolution, there was no discussion of Islamic revolution or Islamic terrorism or what have you. That changes quite dramatically after the Iranian Revolution, and which is seen as a huge threat to Israeli interests, but after the hostage crisis, where personnel at the U.S. Embassy are taken hostage for 444 days. This was covered, this was headline front page news, and it really brought the frame of Islamic terrorism to the United States, right? Because the students that had taken these American personnel hostage were seen as terrorists. Never mind, of course, that the reason they occupy and take these people hostage is because the Shah, who had been deposed in this very democratic revolution that involved the vast majority of Iranian people, students, workers, you know, religious minorities and so on, all of whom were really had real grievances against the U.S.-backed Shah. He had been deposed, and then he comes to the United States where he's given safe harbor. And so they take these you know, embassy personnel hostage to say, return the Shah so that he can actually, you know, be held responsible for the violence and the horror that he and Savak, his security police, trained by the U.S. and Israel, has committed. So that's one very important moment in which the language goes from a focus on Arabs to Iranians and Muslims in particular. But keep in mind, of course, that during the 80s, you also see the rise of Hezbollah in Lebanon. You see the rise of Hamas, which is vying for supremacy of the Palestinian movement with the PLO. And so Israel starts to alter its thinking. I'm not saying that, of course, at the second conference, which was held in 1984, the Jonathan Institute conference, that the PLO is omitted, far from it. The PLO still remains the focus, but there's now a whole panel discussion which didn't exist back in the 1979 conference on so-called Islamic terrorism. And a whole series of Orientalist thinkers, most famously Bernard Lewis, was invited to provide the language around so-called Islamic terrorism. And of course, these people, you know, will then take that moment and generalize it to all time to say that Islam itself is violent, that, you know, Islam, Muhammad was both a political and a religious leader. And so Islamic terrorism is a transhistoric kind of phenomenon. So that's what changes the language. And of course, this finds fertile ground in Reagan's America. He shifts U.S. foreign policy focus away from human rights to terrorism. And you see the introduction of various domestic as well as international counterterrorism policies back in the 1980s. And last thing I'll say about this, Arun, is that even at this point, there isn't an exclusive focus on Muslim terrorists. In fact, what my research shows is that, you know, not just in the New York Times, but even in foreign policy circles and the Reagan elite as well, they're trying to somehow put all their enemies together into this terrorist box. And so they lump together Gaddafi of Libya with Khomeini of Iran and the Sandinistas of Nicaragua to put this conspiracy theory forward that suggests that somehow they're all in cahoots with one another to topple U.S. hegemony around the world. So it's still very much a mixed bag. And this is the moment at which narco-terrorism, right, is a concept that is developed and used later on in the 1990s.
I mean, that's really interesting, Deepa. And it seems to me what's so crucial about the analysis that you're laying out is that, you know, by getting into the sort of fine grain of the history of these different images and connotations in each particular decade from the, you know, from the 60s, 70s, 80s onwards, we get this picture that the association that's so familiar to us now of Islam with terrorism is neither something that's always been there, you know, through the centuries, nor is it something that just kind of spontaneously springs up after 9/11, but has kind of got this generative history that, you know, gradually emerges in quite different forms in each decade, and you know, before you get to something that looks like the familiar images from today.
That's exactly right. I think there's a tendency too often to think of anti-Muslim racism as being this unpunctuated force that's gone from the Crusades to the present. And that's unfortunately a very idealist and non-materialist way of understanding the process of racial formation, if you want to use that language, which is that races are produced at certain moments in order to meet certain needs of the system as such. And so that's the kind of approach that I've taken to an understanding of 9/11 as not inevitable. That is to say, without the actual event of 9/11, I don't think that the kind of policies that we have today that racialize Muslims and Arabs and Iranians and South Asians who get included into this mix in the 1990s, particularly as Pakistan comes into the crosshairs of the United States, all of these are the product of historical events. And it's important, I think, as scholars and activists to understand what's going on in relation to U.S. imperialism's interests and how racialization operates in conjunction with that. I mean, this is not to say that older ideas aren't useful and get brought back and mobilized, but, you know, why, when, and how, those are important questions for us to ask.
And what would you say to someone who said that, you know, one of the implications of your argument is, I suppose, that the idea of the Muslim terrorist is a racist idea, right? And so what would you say to someone who said, well, you know, Muslims are terrorists, at least some of them are, and so why is it racist to think of the idea of the Muslim terrorist?
Right. Well, if you think about the kinds of systematic practices that the US has put into effect since 9/11, I mean, I've spoken about, you know, pre-9/11 surveillance programs and so forth. If you think about, for instance, what's called preemptive prosecution, such as material support for terrorism statutes, right? This existed before 9/11, but it's certainly been, you know, on steroids since then. What happens is that Muslims themselves become a suspect population, so that doing things like giving to charitable organizations. And this is, by the way, one of the pillars of Islam, zakat, to give charity and so forth. That becomes suspicious, and that becomes the basis on which people have been tried in court for allegedly supporting terrorists. So Fahad Hashmi, who is this student in New York City, actually gets thrown into jail for material support for terrorism. Why? Because an acquaintance stayed with him on the way, I believe, either to Pakistan or to Afghanistan. And he was carrying things like raincoats and ponchos and so forth that apparently he later delivered to Al-Qaeda. Now, why somebody is accused of material support for terrorism because somebody else stays with them is a logic that makes absolutely no sense, but it makes complete sense from the point of view of the US criminal justice system, of the court system, and of the national security state, because the counter-radicalization programs and the radicalization programs that you have written brilliantly about basically see all Muslims as already in stage one of a four-step or a five-step process of becoming terrorists, right? So regardless of what you are, what you do, what your politics are, you're already suspicious. That is racist, right? Before somebody can do anything that is deemed threatening, that can be considered terrorist, to see them as suspicious and as potentially dangerous is a racist model of policing. And that's not new. This is how various colonial powers have governed in, you know, colonized nations. And it's what the US has also done in various contexts and is now doing in relation to Muslims and those who look Muslim in the United States. So what you've seen really is an amalgamated racial Muslim that has been brought into being first in the form of Arabs in the 1970s, and then Iranians and other Muslims in the 80s, South Asians, and then, of course, everybody from North Africa all the way to Indonesia has been lumped into this category of being potentially suspicious. And so even though the U.S. justice system does not allow discrimination simply because of one's religion, the actual practices, whether it's systematic mass surveillance, whether it's preemptive prosecution or what have you, actually operates through a logic that racializes Muslims and those who look Muslim.
And how can we think about events like 9/11 in a way that avoids the racist frame of the Muslim terrorist?
Well, before I go there, actually, something else occurred to me, which I want to say a little more about, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Which is, you mentioned how there isn't a trans-historic association of Muslims with terrorism, or that anti-Muslim racism, as I said, has not existed through all time. And I just want to make a few quick comments about that, which is to separate practice from ideology. Too often there's a tendency to see the existence, for instance, of Orientalist language and Orientalist ways of characterizing people from the Middle East, from Iran, from South Asia, or whatever, as automatically implying that there's some sort of systematic racism that's taking place. In fact, in the US, the history is far more checkered than that. First of all, what my research shows is that attitudes towards Muslims were brought to the United States by the British settler colonial population, right? The U.S. is a settler colonial project, and it's the British that are responsible. And so John Smith, who actually cuts his teeth, John Smith of the Pocahontas fan, who actually cuts his teeth fighting the Ottoman Empire, brings those attitudes developed in that context to the United States. And in 1776, the U.S., declares independence and sees itself as a beacon of democracy, and in direct opposition to the tyranny or the despotism, right? It was called Oriental despotism of the Ottomans. So there is that language right from the beginning in the US, but it's also really contradictory. So for instance, abolitionists, when they see that various North African nation states, including the Ottomans and so forth, are beginning to do away and end slavery, they use that as an example to shame the US for continuing to have slavery. The temperance movement also points to, how Muslims are forbidden to drink alcohol to shame the US. Similarly, feminists, they adopt the bloomer. This is a Turkish trouser, which they see as a very practical and somewhat masculine garment. And as Elizabeth Cady Stanton actually says, that the bloomer is an imitation of Turkish style. So you have all sorts of attitudes, imitation, praise, a romantic notion of the region, and so on. And my argument is that it's not until the end of the Second World War and the emergence of the US as one of two key superpowers on the world stage, and when it starts to, you know, spread its hegemony in that region, in North Africa, Middle East, South Asia, and so on, that's when you start to see systematic processes of racialization. And so Arab Americans, who actually were incorporated into a proximity to whiteness, the US has had very racist immigration laws. The immigration law of 1790 basically said that only free white persons could be granted citizenship. And Syrian Christians, who were part of the crew of immigrants that came at the turn of the 19th and the early 20th century, were actually quite successful in winning cases of naturalization, winning citizenship. Actually, they were far more successful than South Asians and East Asians were, and so forth. So they get integrated into a sense of whiteness. But then there's a fall from whiteness just as the U.S. gets ready to establish its hegemony in the Middle East and North Africa. So it's important to see this checkered history and to not understand racism and racialization as somehow this project that is unpunctuated.
Right. And you know, I think a lot of people are familiar with the idea of how the Irish became white in the United States, mm-hmm. right? And what you get with Muslims, from what you've just said, is the reverse process, right? In more recent decades, as they've kind of progressively lost their whiteness, which the fact that is also possible tells us something about what racism is and how it's historically created and how those things can go both ways.
And the boundaries are constantly shifting as right, well. I mean, right. I would be remiss if I didn't talk about the Black Muslim experience in talking about, you know, anti-Muslim racism, because the surveillance that we see through Operation Boulder and later on in the 70s actually begins much earlier for Black Muslims. In the 1930s, J. Edgar Hoover decides that the Moorish Science Temple of America is a huge threat because they are anti-imperialists, they are proud Black internationalists, and so on, and begins a massive program of surveillance against these Black Muslims. And of course, this continues with the Nation of Islam, with Malcolm X, and so forth. So that's another really important component of this whole story. And keep in mind, of course, that Black Muslims were the majority of Muslims, I believe, until the 1970s, which is when the U.S. lifts its, really racist immigration policies, and this allows for more Muslim immigrants to come to the U.S.
Right. So, you know, just coming up to a bit closer to the present day, it seems that the racist idea of the Muslim terrorist seemed to kind of reach its apotheosis.
Yes. Its peak.
Let's say that with Donald Trump's ban on Muslims entering the US, right? I mean, that seemed to me the in a way a kind of culmination of some of this. But you know, now under Biden, I mean, that's been fully rescinded. I mean, where are we now? What do you think is the fate of anti-Muslim racism and you know, the kind of linked imperialism in the US under Biden?
Yeah. No, I mean, first of all, you're absolutely right that the peak moment of anti-Muslim racism is under Trump. I don't think the US has seen a more Islamophobic presidency than under Trump. I mean, he basically legitimated the far right-wing forces who believe that there is a conspiracy by Muslims to take over the United States, to replace the Constitution with Sharia law and all the rest of it. And he actually is able to, in part, win the election based on these racist ideas, xenophobia, anti-Black and anti-Muslim racism, particularly through his attack on Barack Obama, right? So he's one of the people, along with Fox News, that really popularizes birtherism, right? The idea that Obama was born in Kenya, he could not be president, he's not Christian, he's Muslim, he's more loyal to Muslim states than he is to the U.S., and so on. And of course, none of this is true. He is born in Hawaii and so forth. But nevertheless, he really channels this kind of conspiracy right-wing racism, including, I believe, in the year that he was running for elections, He promises to deport all Syrians and to, you know, not allow any more Syrian refugees to escape what was a truly horrific condition at that time, saying that they could all be ISIS, right? And that allowing Syrians to come to the U.S. would make the Trojan horse, you know, be like a joke or what have you. So he essentially shredded Washington's liberal playbook. And at least since the end of the Cold War, there's been a framework that's been in place, a bipartisan framework of liberal hegemony, right? So liberal ideas were used to bolster U.S. imperialism, whether that was human rights or democracy or women's rights, and later on LGBTQ rights and so on. That was the playbook, whether it was Bush or Bush Senior, that is, or Clinton and Bush Jr. and so on. Remember, they were going off to Afghanistan to liberate women, right? Now, Trump comes along and shreds this liberal playbook and adopts, you know, what's been called illiberal hegemony. But if you actually look behind the actual rhetoric, there's more continuity between Obama, Trump, and Biden than there is discontinuity. So one example of this really would be China. Let's take the case of China. So in the early 1990s, there was only a minority of people in the foreign policy establishment that actually saw China as a threat to U.S. hegemony on the world stage. That changes in the Obama years when there's a bipartisan consensus that China should not be allowed to rise. And Obama has this pivot to Asia plan, right? But he is not able to actually realize that. It's Trump who comes in and goes after China in a very concerted way. He says he's going to draw down from the forever wars, and he wants to pivot away from the war on terror. Not to say that he's not using Obama methods, you know, drone strikes and counterinsurgency methods, all sorts of things to maintain U.S. control of that region. But there is an interest in actually going after China. So that's what he does, is he focuses political, economic, and military policy in terms of pushing China back. I'm just thinking of this video that all of us, I think, have seen on YouTube, where you see the number of times that Trump is talking about China, right? China, 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 China. And so that he does do that. He succeeds in shifting resources to China in a way that Obama couldn't. And this hasn't changed under the Biden administration, right? We continue to see this focus around stopping the rise of China, even under Biden. But what you have seen is, of course, a shift in the rhetoric back to liberal hegemony, back to liberal imperialism. And, you know, you have a leadership that's heavily female, people of color. And so this multicultural imperialism and imperial feminism really papers over the continuity, because the rhetoric is better, the posture is better. And really, Biden has brought soft power back. He rejected the Muslim ban. He eliminated the worst excesses of the Trump era in terms of, you know, rejecting conspiracy theories and blatant racism and so forth. But he's following through on Trump's promise to end the forever wars, right? So the U.S. Is drawing down and will be done drawing down from Afghanistan by the end of August. And I haven't seen, you know, in this context, any article, and it could just be me, and maybe there are such articles, but I haven't seen anything that says mission accomplished, women in Afghanistan liberated. Because the truth of the matter is that that hasn't happened. I mean, there have been some improvements in healthcare and so on, but for the most part, you know, Afghan women have actually seen their conditions deteriorate. So specifically in terms of racism in the Biden era, what you see is really liberal racism, right? This effort to bring back colonial feminism, which saw its heyday in the 19th century when Britain and France were occupying large parts of the world, which justified these projects by saying that they are liberating women. And in reality, no women have been liberated anywhere by empire. And certainly that has not been true, in the war on terror era either. So in other words, liberal racism continues, and liberal imperialism is productive of these new forms of racism, because it's fundamentally rooted in the notion that these are barbaric societies and that we as the civilized empire must go and liberate their women, right? Ajit Spivak put it as white men rescuing brown women from brown men. And that logic, which is fundamentally racist and sexist, continues.
Thank you, Deepa. That was amazing. I'm sure we all learned so much. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Arun.
This is the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. Thank you for listening this far. This has been a conversation between TNI associate Arun Kundnani and author and scholar Deepa Kumar. Expect more such content as Arun meets different people who can give a different vision of what global security should look like in an era of pandemics and climate crisis. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at Transnational Institute on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter.